This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 319, Tracking Vinyl Discs. Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, one of your co-hosts, who is delighted to be here. And I can imagine there might be another co-host who might be feeling something about being here. Hello, Michael.
I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, look at that.
To even be one of the co-hosts.
Double delighted. Yeah. All right. So it's just the two of us. For this episode, and we have got all kinds of good fun stuff to get to. So without delay, let's go back. Let's go back in time to a point where music came on vinyl and you could scratch it and you didn't want to scratch it because that would be bad. And then you would want to preserve it. So you would put it onto like a cassette tape, but not like place them together. You'd actually record them electronically. But if you had a whole big collection of records, which, Michael, you do, right? You've got a lot of vinyl, don't you?
I still do, yes. And I listen to it. I enjoy it.
And you know, you get that visceral experience of like pulling the dust off of it with the, you know, the liquid and the duster and everything, I'm guessing, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, apparently, the Internet Archive has digitized, according to this article from Open Culture, 250,000 records. And you've probably done at least half of that, given your collection, right?
No. These are 78 RPMs.
Oh, yes, they are.
They've got many more than 250,000. There's 250,000 78 RPMs, which I believe were acetate, not vinyl.
I see.
So I mean, this is really old music. And one of the, I don't know if you're a fan of records, right? But a 78. I think held like 2.5 or 3 minutes per side. And then when you switched it to the 33 RPMs, you got to like 15 to 20 minutes per side because the tracks were closer together. They were denser. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just fascinating to understand how these were built. And even before this, you had the wax cylinders, sure. which were like wax toilet paper rolls with little knobs on it, which matched, if you think about it, the old player pianos.
Right.
So they took the piano designs and turned them into the wax cylinders.
I used to have a little music box thing with a little hand crank on it that would have little knobs that would go plinkety plink onto little metal bits.
Like a player piano. That's
like
how
player piano
work.
Exactly. Yeah. So I actually, you know what? It didn't quite, you know, resonate with me, the 78 aspect of this. That is actually really cool.
And that's the one thing I don't have. I don't have any 78s. I've got LPs, so 33.3s.
Right.
I've got 45 RPMs. I've got EPs, which were extended play, which were usually like 9 minute long dance mix albums, or sorry, records. I do have cassettes still. I have lots of CDs. And I, about a year and a half ago, picked up, no, actually for Christmas this year, I got some new LPs. So there's a lot of artists that have gone back to at least releasing a limited set of heavy LPs. So they're a lot thicker vinyl. So I enjoy it.
Well, now this takes on even added significance. I thought it was cool about taking pictures of the label art in the middle of the record and liner notes and everything like that. Certainly, you have a larger form factor, so you could capture more of that. But this is a much bigger deal. How cool!
Yeah,
love it.
Really cool.
And if you want to see how they did it, you know, hit the go button and you'll see.
I actually have an RCA Y jack to an 8mm adapter that plugs into my sound card that I use from my stereo, in order to rip LPs.
So are you done, or do you still have some
to do? Yeah, I'm done, but I get new ones every once in a while, and I rip those.
Yeah, nice. All right, so staying on the idea of digitization, again, having to pronounce that very carefully so I don't trip over the tongue, there was a fun post that was sent my direction from a colleague about the UNC archives of the UNC Department of Computer Science, which has always been one of the leaders in virtual reality. And this was a VHS tape that has now been basically uploaded into YouTube. So you can go and watch and see what was done in the early 1990s in this space. And it was about 9 minutes long, which you could certainly fit more than that onto a VHS tape. But still, that was, you know, a good amount of time to see what was state of the art at the time and what was being created and innovated upon at the time, too. And part of me, when I went through this action and watched it, what struck me was we've come so far. And part of me was, we haven't really come far at all.
Well, that's the funny thing is just looking at the design of the headset, headset, right? It's an Oculus.
Yep.
Now it's a little bit bigger, not significantly bigger. It's a little bit bigger, but yeah, it's amazing. I'm sure that was probably a $20,000 rig back then.
Oh, though, yeah, right? Yeah. At the time, the 20K really meant something too, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really bizarre because I'm trying to remember when Dave and Buster's took off. Because I remember in the mid to late 90s, right, Dave and Buster's was around and you would go and they had a VR room for VR games. So it's not very far off. So this was 1991, right?
Right.
So within 5 years, they took it out of the university and the military setting, et cetera, and put it in a video arcade. And then it's taken us another almost 30 years to make it in the house.
Absolutely. And maybe one other little fascinating thing I saw from this video, too, before we leave it, is that in one example, they had a haptic force feedback arm so that you could handle this controller. And it went from this arm, robotic arm kind of thing, all the way up into the ceiling so that when you bounced up against something in the virtual world, you actually could feel it with the controller because it would bounce against you. So, you know, not exactly what you get out of a PS, you know, PlayStation controller these days, but it was interesting to see what was being researched at the time to give heft and weight to a virtual experience and what bumping into or manipulating objects might actually do.
Yeah, yeah, very cool.
So come a long way, but not nearly far enough. Now, if we take that same thought and we blend it into the future, our friend Ian has shared with us a patent from Sony about what goes on in the virtual worlds, specifically around the dynamic creation of interior spaces. So if you've got a city like they had in the UNC example, and you're flying around the city and you're looking in the windows of various buildings, you might have an interior view, or you might actually go in depending on how the virtual world works. And most of the time they are exactly the same. Right. You know, the same setup, the same thing. So if you want to dynamically create differences, that's computationally intensive. And this here is an intriguing patent that says, hey, based on a number of factors, we can now randomize and create what an interior might look like. And then that way you're not seeing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, it's funny. We've talked a lot over the years of procedurally generated worlds, and it was all about landscape and terraforming, but never about the buildings themselves and what's in them. And I was thinking about this actually the other day from the standpoint of how good Microsoft Flight Sim is at rendering 3D worlds now based off of just photogrammetry, I probably can't pronounce that word correctly, of taking the satellite images and other photos to render out my neighborhood. I flew over my neighborhood recently in Flight Simulator. I've flown over my parents' house and, you know, those things like that. And it's really, really gotten good, but you could not look through the windows. And using something like this would just take you to that next level of reality from a virtual or an augmented reality perspective. This is really cool. And understanding that, you know, a two-story house with this type of thing on the roof is more likely an office building than a home, right?
Sure.
Or an apartment complex, and then using that information to dynamically generate, saying, you know, the window above the door is probably not a bedroom, right? It's probably a hallway, or, you know, all these types of rules that can be identified or generated or learned through an AI model, and then use that to actually generate those interiors. Very cool.
Absolutely. And I couldn't help but think about the whole Matrix kind of structure, because there are occasions when, just going about my everyday business, I'm like, I look left and I see a car, and I look right and I see like the same model car. It's like, okay, well, the Matrix is taking a day off here because the random car generator didn't really
do its job. Yeah. But what if you like looked in that home and one day everything was there, and the next day you go in and it's gone?
Awesome. So there's an article that showed up in our feeds from Kotaku about Oculus homes, where people spend a lot of time and energy decorating and putting various digital things. When you walk in after a little while, it looks like you have been wiped out, that someone busted into your home and took all of your digital couches and all your base are belong to us.
Well, I remember playing early, well, not early, it was kind of mid time frame of Star Wars Galaxies, once you could build your own homes and you could take your loot and set them up, and you would go into people's places and they'd have the crafting station, and, you know, they would have all the suits of armor that they built for their various characters on display. And, you know, I can imagine the amount of effort, because I spent a lot of time of building out that custom space to then find somebody coming in and ransacking your virtual environment. Now, the question is, could they just restore a backup?
You would think, right?
Well, I don't know, because you're talking about, this is backed up on the server. You would have to, you know, raise a support ticket, get the support team to go dig through their archives and understand what was going on at some point to do the restore, right? Not impossible, but on a scale of a open world, maybe improbable that they've even got decent backups for that type of thing.
Would be a whole lot better if they could just randomly, you know, populate your home with furniture. That might be appropriate.
Yes, and maybe they could use a Sony patent to generate the right stuff.
Maybe so. All right. Well, moving right along to something of great interest. Lots of news stories around this these days, around app tracking. So this is the functionality we've talked about a little bit in the latest version 14.5 or 14.5.1 of iOS. And this article from MacRumors talks about the percentage of people that have decided to allow apps to ask you if it's okay if they track you.
Yeah, I threw this one into the show notes as really a follow-up to our discussion last week, where I was talking about the tyranny of the default.
Yep.
Right? And you know, you and I both had reached out to friends and family to say, hey, this update came out, you really need to turn it on, and oh, by the way, check out the tracking setting. And this is the perfect example of the tyranny of the default working to the benefit of the user, right? So of all people who have updated to iOS 14.5, 96% of them to date, and this is a little over a week now, a week and a half, have left the default setting on the tracking privacy, which is don't allow apps to track you. Right? And this is after Facebook and other advertise-driven companies have literally ran campaigns to say, hey, you need to turn on tracking because it's good for you. And you can see a little bump of that campaign in the first day of the launch, right? The first 2 days, they went from 2% of users to 4% have left the tracking on. And that's where we're at. And it stayed that way for the last few weeks now. I think this is great. And it once again shows, you know, if you set the defaults, people tend to keep them that way. And so if you're going to have defaults, set them to the benefit of your user.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that that's super important. But this shows, as you said, Michael, the power of the opt-in versus opt-out. And I like having the thumb on this on the side of the scale that benefits the user, too.
Yep.
Okay, so we're going to move from tracking from an app's perspective to tracking from a physical perspective, and a couple of articles that were of note and interest this week. So the first one, Michael, you saw was how iFixit took Apple's AirTags and did something interesting.
Yeah, so I know you and Andy have both ordered your AirTags. I don't believe you gotten them yet.
Nope, not yet.
I have not ordered any yet because I, you know, If someone got me one, I'd be okay with it, but I really have no need right now.
Or an R2-D2, that'd be fine too, right?
Yeah, or a giant Lego R2-D2. But I don't tend to lose things. The one thing that I've ever really lost on a plane are prescription sunglasses.
Ooh.
And I don't think I'm going to put a big AirTag in the middle of my sunglasses. That would be bizarre.
It'd be very stylish, Michael.
And what's worse is I realized it shortly thereafter and went immediately and called the airport. And they're like, yeah, when we find find sunglasses on a plane, we just throw them away.
Wow. Like, are you kidding
$600
me?
$600 prescription sunglasses. That is unbelievable. And it's like, you're not going to take them and go, hey, I got some glasses, I'm going to wear them, right? Because they're prescription. They wouldn't work for the anyway. But I digress. So AirTags are out, people are getting them. And, you know, one of the biggest complaints is you get it and you can't really use it to start with because you can't connect it to anything, right? You can't put it on things. And so why couldn't Apple just put a hole in it so you can hang it on a keychain as an example?
Oh, like the other competitors too?
Like the other competitors, right. And yeah. So iFixit, who always does the teardown of the latest tech, they actually show that there is a fairly precise way that you could drill a hole into the AirTag case that does not do any damage to it, and at least have a place that you can put a hook on it to put it to your keychain. So, you know, not very destructive, makes it a lot easier. And, you know, I can't believe that you don't have some way of connecting it without spending, you know, $10 for a generic branded one and up to $450, as we talked about, to some kind of case to hold it, to attach it to something. So, very cool. Nice little example of somebody hacking through this to figure this one out.
Yep, absolutely. And the noise you're hearing in the background was me looking through my desk drawers to see if I had any of those batteries that are necessary for replacing on the AirTags. And I'm glad to see that I do. So I'm probably going to be good for like 2 years at this point.
Yeah. Well, it comes with the battery out of the box. You should be okay at least for the first year.
That's what I'm saying. The first year I can be using the battery in the box, and then the second year I could use a battery that I already have. So
yes,
yay, awesome possum. Well, all right, let's move along to fixing another problem, which is not from iFixit this time, but the AirTag itself for some is too thick in its form factor, and they wish they would just, you know, make it thinner and maybe make it from aluminium.
Yeah, there's a guy named Andrew Nagai, I believe is how you pronounce it, who decided that he wanted to track his wallet, right? Mm-hmm. So he stuck the AirTag in it, and, you know, the AirTag is a PCB and a battery and a case, right?
Right.
So the PCB is about as thick as the battery. So you're already two times the thickness of the battery. And then you add the case, and it's, you know, it's, what is that, 6-8 millimeters thick at that point?
Which
is pretty chunky.
I wonder if that's comparable to a pound coin.
Well, this is pretty interesting. The CR 2032 battery.
Ah, yeah.
There was a fact that the guy gave in the video is actually named based off of two things. It's 20 millimeters wide, so in diameter.
Uh-huh.
And 3.2 millimeters thick.
Oh.
A 2032 battery. So 3.2 plus 3.2 plus 3.2 for the case.
A smart
almost,
name.
Almost a full centimeter thick is what you think about it. It's pretty thick when you stack it all together. So what he decided to do was, after watching the iFixit teardown, to tie the stories together,
yep.
He actually figured out how to take the AirTag apart so that you could have the battery lay next to the control board, right? Mm-hmm. So now it's 3.2 millimeters thick. And then he realized how to hook the battery up, printed a 3D holder for it that's about the size of a credit card.
Right.
So now you just have an extra 3.2 millimeter thick credit card in your wallet. That's your AirTag. And he actually shows a full walkthrough of how he does it, how he designed it, and that it works. I was impressed by this. This is cool.
That's pretty nifty. I'm eager to get mine because I'd like to compare the AirTag to a pound coin because I know for many people in the U.S., a wallet is for credit cards and paper money only. However,
silent money.
I've always had shrapnel, you know, the coins in my wallet as well. And I know that's not a typical U.S. thing. So I wonder if that was the design point of just put it in with your change. And the case should protect it from getting, you know, banged around with pound coins and other stuff like that.
Yeah, it's funny because U.S. wallets, you're right. U.S. wallets don't, at least U.S. mail wallets, don't tend to have a change purse attached to it.
Yes. And I wouldn't call it a purse. It's a coin pocket.
Whatever.
All right. One more on Apple AirTags.
Yes.
And I appreciate this guy having a unicorn on the custom logo. So well done, you. Unicorns are awesome. This is all about a special developer menu, which I'm going to be really eager to give a shot to once mine arrive.
Well, this is my question. How long will this feature be enabled?
Not long at all, probably.
I'm guaranteeing. I won't guarantee. I predict that a soon to be released beta release of iOS turns this feature off. But evidently, somebody was frustrated with their AirTag, and they just started tapping on the app, and they ended up tapping 5 times in the top left corner of the AirTag Find My app. Mm-hmm. So the Find My app. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that enables developer mode so that you can see all the debugging logic and overlays on the Find My screen to track a nearby AirTag. It's kind of cool.
That's very cool. I have to wonder, too, if there is a little bit of a spatial audio Geiger counter sort of thing that if you're wearing AirPods, to look for your AirTags, that if it's behind you, it sounds like it's behind you.
Well, you know, with the most recent updates allowed you to have spatial audio, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it would go bleep, 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 bleep.
Yeah, or something like that, right?
Well, see, if I want to spend a lot of extra time on this week's edit, you will have heard that movement as I moved around my microphone.
Ah.
Guess what? I'm not going to do that.
Oh, well. But isn't it cool, too? It's like the haptic. It says haptics, arm's reach, right? So when it's really close by, you know, it's like It's arm's reach, right? So that's a nice little developer code there. And if it's not, you know, it's somewhere else. Cool stuff. We'll see.
Yeah. It just shows you all the telemetry data that they get from the U1 chip and the other devices around, right? I mean, you can see how it's triangulating the location.
Oh,
very cool.
Yes, and right back again to what we talked about last week or the week before, the notion that if you have a few Apple devices around you, there's a lot that's tracking that can I help you and help you find and identify. I was, I don't remember where I read this, Michael, but somewhere there was a story talking about using AirTags in your luggage. And
yes,
that would be a great use case. So it's like, okay, so where is it? You know, is it still on the plane? Is it on the board? You know, is it coming through? Whatever. And the people who were giving that a test run were saying that it wasn't finding it at this level of specificity until like it was like right in front of you. So an AirTag moving is a little bit more difficult than a stationary one. You know, we'll see. We're going to play with this stuff as it comes. Yeah, all right. Cool. Moving along from the wallet to the wrist. There is a notion around adding sensors that a projected future, maybe coming sort of kind of never know, Apple Watch in 2022 could do some interesting things about, what are they suggesting? Blood alcohol levels? Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I believe, God, 5 years ago or more, you and I talked after I was at a conference with a member of the team that did some of the outside of Apple testing of these sensors that are on the back of the Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. And it was a research scientist group meeting that I was at. And at that time, they talked about how you could leverage the sensors to do blood pressure monitoring, which we have not seen yet on the Apple Watch.
True.
But they are talking in this article, you know, a potential Apple Rockley Photonics partnership that would enable things like blood pressure monitoring, which is great.
Blood and non-invasive sugar levels. Blood
that
sugar,
one I don't understand how they do that, right? And body temperature I think is easy. Blood pressure, I know that can be done. Blood sugar levels, non-invasive blood sugar, that's the one. I don't understand the tech yet on that one. That will be very interesting to see. Well, when you think about the cost of to an insurance plan of somebody who's on a, you know, real-time blood sugar monitoring device.
Oh, yeah. I mean, glucose monitoring is super interesting. And the article here does talk a little bit about absorption spectroscopy. So perhaps what's happening there is that the green light that's on the back of your Apple Watch that's going through your skin will then reflect and refract in different ways depending upon the amount of sugar. Just guessing. Well, I don't know.
Yeah. It's got to be something like that. And, you know, it's one of the things I've started changing how I wear my Apple Watch. I actually have a tighter watch band and I push it further up my arm. So it's not like dangling right, you know, at the hand on the wrist, only because it improves the sensors.
Right. I've read about that too. And if you really are looking for better accuracy, you want to put it like up on your bicep or something.
Yeah, which makes it really hard to check the time.
Yeah, or to like engage with other things.
Yes.
But you could look really cool and cyborg-esque, right? Oh my gosh, where did the time go, Michael?
We are running quickly out of time to talk about.
Interesting privacy stuff. And this is one, we've talked something about similar to this already once or twice before. So The Verge had an article about getting data from your car. And your car being able to tell those that want to interrogate your car interesting things about you.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a couple times. There's examples, you know, Tesla has a black box in their vehicles, and they're able to do analysis of, you know, was the driver actually paying attention when the, quote, self-driving car, which is not self-driving, ran under something? The thing that most people don't realize is that for really, I want to say 6-10 years now, the amount of telemetry data, even longer than that, the amount of telemetry data that the average car collects is just phenomenal. And on top of that, when you think about the fact that almost every car you get now, even what are considered, you know, low-end entry vehicles, are going to have an ADAS system built in with built-in GPS, built-in network communications back to the automaker or the dealership or whatever. All of that exists now. So the ability to get enough data to understand why events have occurred has gotten a lot of people concerned. It's not like you're in a airplane where it's you and 300 other people on, quote, public transportation.
Right.
Or commercial transportation. This is you in your private vehicle that you own. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out from a privacy and a legal perspective over the next few years as we get more and more to the point where we're driving closer to electric vehicles, we're driving closer to network vehicles, we're driving closer to vehicle-to-vehicle communications in order to improve a lot of the services that vehicles have today.
What one would hope that the security, which we've also talked about from an Internet of Things and other perspective too, that a vehicle would be subject to the same kinds of protections that a phone is and a phone has.
Well, but it's interesting. One would hope. But I do know that if you think about things like GDPR, mm-hmm. right? Which is the Global Data Protection Regulation in Europe. I believe those are what the terms stand for. The businesses are allowed to collect data to run their business.
Provided that they ask for it, and they ask for it in an understandable fashion, and that you have the right to revoke that access. Yes.
It's at, yes, at a high level, but if you go down into the details, there's lots of different things that make it more interesting, and that's a regulatory environment for only certain countries. And so I think this has to play out through the legislation and legal system in many, many different countries before we'll know what the details are going to be as it relates to I get a new car, I run a stop sign, and I hit another car. Does the government or the police or the insurance company have the right to look at that data right out of the box, right?
Yeah, and I think we're
and then also sell that data to insurance to advertisers.
And we're also on the same vector of what about how this flows from a from an opt-in opt-out perspective too.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So for the services Very cool. that you want and for the services that you're willing to pay for, you know, how does that all come together? Lots of interesting stuff. I think we have enough time to maybe hit the last couple of things that are here, hopefully.
Yep.
Knowing,
big shout out.
Knowing how exciting space is these days with all the things going on Mars, we have an Earth terrestrial example here of SpaceX having a Yahoo success about landing.
Yes. And I've watched so many of these things fail. It's nice to see they actually landed one.
Yep. And Starship landing nominal, according to the future host of Saturday Night Live. So that's pretty cool.
I love that term, nominal.
Nominal. All systems nominal. Speaking of all systems nominal, or go for that matter, it's a little shout out to our co-host Andy for being featured in the Linux format this month. We'll yes. put a little picture of him up there. That's super deluxe cool. And we've got two movie-related things to close out for today, Michael.
Yes.
Both of which are ones that you are kind of keen on, I think. Peachy keen on.
Yes, I'm a huge fan of Loki in the Thor universe of Marvel Universe. And Disney is starting to bring out all their Loki advertisements for the new show that'll be beginning on June 9th. So that's a couple of days early, Woo-hoo. Right during WWDC. So that looks to be fun. And, you know, what was special about this week? Well, this week was the week of May the 4th, or Star Wars Day. And in honor of that, this week, I saw this article, put it in the show notes, with a video that has the complete canon timeline up through 2021. Highly recommend if you're a Star Wars fan. It's about an hour watch. Watch this. It's really cool.
That's awesome. And I notice here, just to get the Lego bit in here one more time, that you can see a Lego The Mandalorian with some Boba Fett action going on too. Excellent. So how cool is that?
Very cool.
Love it. All right. Well, everyone, thanks for tuning in and listening. We hope to have you back again in a week's time. And if between now and then you have some intriguing articles that you're seeing, whether they're space related, disc related, video related, AI, VR, hello, send them our way. We'd love to talk about them on the next edition of gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.